Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And this is the Personal Wealth Coach with technical difficulties, not as unusual. And we're going to play around with the system here and see if we can make it work a little better. But if you were to hear us the way we hear us, you would be surprised. I think it's the main lead line in there.
Okay.
Maybe. Okay.
I think I'm better now.
Oh, well, I'm not. So we'll continue to mess with this. Okay. I'm
Is
still
that
not
better?
No, but that's all right.
Let me mess with it.
Okay.
Oh, we got somebody calling in.
We got someone calling in. Okay, so this is the person. Ooh, it certainly started. What'd you do? Okay, that's it.
Is that better?
There's something here. When you move some, there it is, right there. It's that line right there. That's the in line. It's got a short in it. Okay. Whoa. Yeah, okay. Whatever that is, it's not working. Now I can't hear myself at all. Wait a minute. Okay. And now I can. No, it's
nope.
It comes and goes vigorously. Something.
How's that?
That's much better. Okay.
Okay.
Well, not actually, but that's okay. Just leave it like it is because
you can hear something.
I can hear something. Okay, we do have a caller. Let's back up. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are not only a radio program, we are also an SEC registered investment advisory firm out of Salado, Texas. I normally say that far more artfully, but with the feedback I'm getting into my headphones, the fact that I can say anything is astonishing. The telephone numbers in here today, presuming this is Saturday, June 7th, are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we're working here with cutting-edge 1950s technology. So we are getting, okay, he's on the line, he's cool. Okay, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, long-time listener. I've been reading about this silver fix in the Wall Street Journal. And apparently after 117 years, they're getting ready to change or consider changing whatever that is. Can you enlighten me on what the silver fix is? I mean, it's scary just to even hear why they call it that. Is there a similar one for gold? And how does that affect spot prices for precious metals every day? I'll hang up on this.
All right.
I think you have asked a question that's worthy of a doctoral dissertation, but
yeah.
Other than that, that's not a problem. You want to talk about it?
Well, let me begin by saying any commodity, it is totally legal to fix the prices on. If you think back to the movie Trading Places, where there's commodities going on, and the only reason why illegality happened there, and that's Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are in this, and they're in the commodities market. And the only reason why any illegality was going on there was that they bribed a government official before fixing the market. When it comes to commodities, if you want to buy a lot of apples, you're allowed to buy a lot of apples. If you want to buy a lot of pork belly or bacon, you're allowed to buy as much as you want. And when it comes to precious metals, banks have a lot of precious metals. They go back for millennia having lots of precious metals. Actually, the banks that exist today are probably mid-1600s. And anytime you get into a metal that's primary purpose is not industry. Its primary purpose is just because it's rare. Then the ability to fix it becomes paramount. It becomes extremely important to the governments involved if they have currency backed by that system, or to the banks that use it as reserves. So yes, there is a fixing that happens on gold and on platinum and on silver, and for that matter, on diamonds. If you think about the De Beers group, they are not in the same monopolistic position that they once were. But if you look at the price of a diamond is far more prolific. There are a lot more diamonds than there are rubies. So why is it that diamonds are more expensive? Because people are controlling the supply. When it comes to silver, when it comes to gold, well, gold is you asked specifically about gold. the vast majority of gold that has been dug up, and there hasn't been a massive amount when you think about the history of the world, the vast majority of that is either owned by banks or by governments. So all it takes is a bank or a government saying, I want to sell. The other banks and governments get together and say, I wish you wouldn't do that so much. And this is something, you can look this up very clearly. There's a whole series of meetings that took place over this. Part of the reason why gold prices are where they are is because South Africa's economy would collapse without it. And because Russia is still pretty dependent on it. But if you think about what causes the price of any commodity to go up or down, it is, I'm going to get very technical here, supply and demand.
I think you may be referring to a specific item here.
He is. I'm
Kitco
sure.
Kitco has come out with a new fixing, silver fix.
Mm-hmm.
The term silver fix or gold fix is basically we go with it. There's somebody that sets a generally sets a price from which everything else sort of radiates and is adjusted. It's kind of like the LIBOR, which we discovered, of course, is an artificial price that can be manipulated by banks and was.
Right. I was actually coming to that, but okay. you're taking it the right direction.
But historically, it's been done by some supposedly impartial international agency. A lot of times newspapers, just like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the newspapers or a news organization or a bank that supposedly is impartial sets a fixing on prices of something based on trades, and they calculate it out.
Yeah, in this case, it's based on a survey that they've done. Another third-party impartial supposedly system did a survey, and so this...
What Kitco is doing, and I think that's probably what you're referring to, they sell, and to a lesser degree buy, a tremendous amount of precious metals. And they're in the business of promoting and selling precious metals, and they also will trade with the people who have bought from them. And they, what they've done is they have a unique, quote, unique algorithm they have created that averages the spot price between bid and offer on the wholesale silver market, quoted by internationally recognized bullion dealers. And, of course, their unique algorithm is secret. And so what they're doing is they're continually searching for bid and sale prices, bid offer prices, on the Internet. And they have a, quote, unique algorithm that somehow manages to average those together according to what they think the weighting should be from each dealer, and they come up with a price. And that's neat. That's really wonderful. But it should tell you something.
Well, I'm going to give a comparison to let some people know that, one, it's not as scary as it sounds, and two, it's scarier than it sounds. So there. So I can cover both ends of the spectrum very nicely here.
Right. Well...
Well, let me say why it's not as scary. If we're talking about stocks, say there's a corporation out there and it's publicly traded, and there are a lot of people that buy and sell it. Sometimes you get these clumps of sales that hit together all at once. And if there's not somebody that's sitting there holding a pool of that stock ready to sell it or buy it, the stock is a lot more volatile. So in the stock market, that's called a market maker. They buy large quantities of that stock, and different broker-dealers, different dealers, hold that stock, and they make a market in it to help the volatility stay low. So that's why it's not as scary as it might be. Now let me go to the other end, in that those market makers in the United States, particularly in the stock market, are heavily scrutinized. They are regulated to a level that makes when you go to do a checkup for your own health, it makes it look a little bit comfortable. So the market makers in our system that deal with publicly traded stock, when we talk about blue sky, which is just the concept of ownership rather than a physical thing that you own. If you own a stock certificate, you own the concept of an ownership of a company, which is only a concept in paper and people's minds. So if you look at gold and silver, there's a lot less regulation, and in this case, it's being done overseas. So you're...
So what Kitco's come up with is they take a New York silver fix at 10 a.m., a UK silver fix
at the London Metal Exchange,
the Mumbai silver fix, and the 10 a.m. Hong Kong silver fix, which gives them 4 points around the world where trades are averaged together. It is very complex, and it really boils down to the fact that there is no central market where the price of gold or silver is, as Jake was saying, both made and regulated. It is an unregulated market. It is subject to manipulation. No one attempts to stop the manipulation. There have been lots of cases where people have gotten in trouble for falsely manipulating the market. In other words, consciously doing something but denying they're doing it. And they get in trouble for the denying they're doing it.
Not for doing it.
You know, and it's the metals, the precious metals markets are extremely dangerous on many occasions and sometimes for very, very long periods of time. In other words, somebody can run a dealer, a nation, can and will, and even banks and nations will conspire together to manipulate the price of gold and silver.
And not just gold and silver. There's another.
Also diamonds, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, anything that's held just for its rarity is going to be in there, and that includes currencies. George Soros is the man known in Britain as the man that nearly broke the pound, because he cornered a large chunk of the market on the British pound and then shorted it and sold it at massive amounts and caused the pound to drop in value overnight to an extreme amount.
I want to point out why this silver fix is being put in place.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty simple. When Kitco Metals puts a silver fix in place and says this is a price, then derivatives can be created that where people buy contracts for the future price of silver, for example, and every time one of those is bought or sold or their fix is used, Kitco gets a small, very small percentage of every trade, which is phenomenally valuable to Kitco. For instance, every time you do business with a Standard & Poor's 500 stock index fund, the fact that they say S&P 500 on it, which is a trademarked name, I don't remember who it belongs to now.
McGraw-Hill, I think.
No, McGraw-Hill sold it to somebody. But at any rate, whoever owns that trademark gets a few cents for every trade and every time it's used. And that amounts to some really, really, really big money. So it is a natural outgrowth of what else is going on in the market, which is that a lot of people are trying to make money off of anything they can make money off
of. Still McGraw-Hill.
Oh, it is still McGraw-Hill?
Yeah.
The publishers, McGraw-Hill, own S&P 500, which is...
Oh, the whole Standard & Poor's, all of the indexes, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, Standard & Poor's itself... Is it owned by McGraw-Hill or just the S&P 500 index?
The Standard & Poor's, the company itself.
That is very strange. A publisher of books.
Well, Standard & Poor's was a news media organization.
Was
before
it?
Yeah.
Okay. At any rate, it's you start digging down into the depths of indexes or indices, if you prefer, and the derivatives from that spring from that, and you find what I refer to as strange bedfellows. It's certainly fascinating. Hope that answered your question.
Yeah, the original Standard & Poor's was Henry Poor, who was an author and started a book company. And he updated some he made guidebooks, basically, that every year he would come out with a couple of guidebooks on stocks, on investing, on that sort of thing. And another guy did a statistics company. I think it was called Standard Statistics. And when they merged, it was Standard and Poor's. And so they did statistical books. And it was a lot like Ibbotson's Corporation was recently. And that was acquired by someone. So
Morningstar,
which is another statistical organization. Well, Standard & Poor's was purchased because they were doing books more than they were doing statistics over the long term. McGraw-Hill came and purchased them. And then, so basically, it goes back to something we've talked about with indexes for a long time. Indexes are arbitrarily created things so that we can have an anchor point, a thing that we can say, this is what happened today, without talking about what happened to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stocks individually.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, speaking of the S&P 500 stock index, over the last week, it's up 1.34%. Year to date, it's up a whopping 5.47, which sounds like it's pretty anemic until you realize that we're not quite halfway through the year yet.
Annualize that, it's about 11%.
Right. So, well, it goes up to around 12 if it keeps going. And then 52-week, in other words, the 12-month return, about 18.62, which is certainly excellent. The Dow's up about 11 for a year. Year to date, it's up 2, and it was up. Of that, too, it was up 1.24% this last week, which, again, is a sort of a telling thing. The high returns we had last year in those equity indexes are already starting to revert to the mean and become normal, far more normal historical returns. So we're basically charging along in a slow but very consistent deleveraging recovery. And, of course, I threw an interesting word in there, deleveraging, and that's still going on. The United States, for example...
Deleveraging just means lowering the debt.
Lowering debt in general, not the debt.
Well,
because,
the debt.
Because what we've got in the United States is a total debt load across the entire country. That is 300 and some, I don't remember the exact numbers, 300 and some percent of our gross domestic product. And this is not the federal debt. Federal debt is actually relatively low. But we still have some very, very substantial personal debt in the United States, and we still have some substantial corporate debt in the United States. And we got well above the mean for a while, and we have been whittling it down. We're still whittling it down. Europe is still whittling down their debt slowly. And then one of the reasons that you hear about a slow recovery and there's this sense of a slow recovery is because following a financial crisis like the one we had, it's normal to go through an extensive delevering process, meaning that if we can do this consistently and we can do it carefully on a global basis, we get some very positive results. It is a difficult thing to manage, and I think the Federal Reserve has done an excellent job. Because funny thing about debt, we have to have it. And for those of you who think that, for instance, the federal debt is too high, it's not. It's lower than any other developed nation in the United States, the federal debt. It is higher than it has been, and that... I know that sounds strange, but it's basically a good thing. And I've said this in the past, but I'm going to say it again. The United States has been effectively out of debt twice. Once was in 1837, and immediately thereafter we had the worst depression in our history, worse than 1929. And the second one was in 1929, where once again we basically got out of debt, paid off our debt, and immediately plunged into a depression. This is not at all abnormal when this type of thing happens. This time, we managed to dodge the bullet. We didn't. If you think about it, this all, you can back up to 2000 when we started running a surplus, and you start to see the things that occurred following that are pretty typical. But the important thing to recognize is that it's very, very important to retire that debt slowly. And let me tell you why. If you let's have a hypothetical family making, and I realize this is an absurdly low number for a family to make in a year.
I was about to come in with the median income, if you the United States median income, the median is the person right in the middle, not the average. The median income is $51,324. Okay, that's according to the Census Bureau. And I'm going to give you another median number before you get on to...
That's a family now. Right. That's not an
family,
individual.
A family income.
And most families have two workers.
Right. The median home price, and that includes rental houses, because if they're renting the house, the house has this as a median, is $221,000.
That's not a good correlation.
Right. So when you have the two don't go together very well because... a lot of people live in apartments.
Right.
But if you look at the fact that some people are going to have down payments on their homes, even if you begin to say, all right, we've got still over 60% of the people own their own homes, and that's a very healthy number, we're still looking at a 1-to-3 ratio for income to debt, which is about what the United States has overall.
The thing I want to emphasize here, we talk about paying off our debt on a national basis, paying off our debt on an individual basis as being a very healthy thing.
And it is long-term.
The problem is, if we do it too quickly, we get a depression. Let me explain why. And why the employment rates are so important and the median income rates are so important, and why there's a lot of worry among economists, because... very frankly, the median income is just not keeping up.
Correct.
And because ultimately everything we produce, minus exports, and exports, it gets a little complicated when you start throwing in exports. Well, let's just leave the exports out for just a moment.
Well, GDP's got net of
right,
all that
but
stuff.
let's leave the exports out. In an economy, someone makes something for the purposes of selling it to someone else. Now, the people who buy it either buy it to make other things, which case it hasn't finished out its life cycle yet, or it is bought by consumers, people who use it and it's gone. For example, when you buy a loaf of bread at the grocery store, it is not resold in any form or fashion. You eat it. And as a result, it is consumed. But the same thing actually applies to a large extent to when you buy an automobile. Yes, the automobile is useful in that it enables you to work, and the bread enables you to work as well. But when you resell your automobile, in most cases, people tend to keep their automobiles quite an extended period of time right now, and most automobiles that are sold by when you trade in are actually losses to the dealer. They sell them to somebody who probably will tow them to Mexico, and there's very little recovery. This is consumer behavior. Things are made in the United States with the intent of generating a profit, with the intent of being sold to the consumer. So the more money that consumers have to spend, the better our economy runs, the faster our economy runs. The problem is if they get too much money, then there is more demand than there is supply, so the prices start to go up and we get inflation. It's an interesting little balance. But let's back up out of that little equation and note something.
I've got my pen out. Hold on.
We were talking about the fact that the average family makes 51, the median family makes, on average, the median family makes $51,000.
Right.
If they're taking, and of course they'll pay taxes on that, and the taxes probably... I don't know what the taxes are on $51,000 family, probably around 10%. So now they're making about $40,000. Let's just say they're taking another $10,000 a year, and I know that's maybe excessive, and they're using it to pay off debt. Well, that only leaves them $30,000 to spend on buying things. Whereas before, if they didn't have any debt, they could spend $40,000 on buying things. Or if they were to keep their debt at a constant level and increase their debt, then they could spend maybe $45,000 buying things. Multiply that times the millions of families in the United States, and you begin to see a really big number appear. And that number is how much money is being spent buying things that somebody else makes. And whoever makes them and whoever sells them employs people. It's a nice little cycle. So if there is more money going into the system to buy things to be used by consumers, our economy grows. If instead the consumers are putting a large portion of their money into paying for things they bought years ago, paying down their debt, the economy does not grow. It starts to shrink because the money's not being spent in a place where it creates jobs. It's being spent in a place where it pays off bonds or causes banks to have less money on their loan side of their ledger.
Right.
But it doesn't create jobs for more people to buy money. And you can get into a cycle. That's the deflationary cycle. You can get into this cycle here very easily in a deflationary environment, which, by the way, they have in Europe right now, where we put off buying things. We save our money. We put off buying things. We pay off debt. Sounds very virtuous, except for the fact that it throws us into a depression.
Yeah, here's the thing, and this popped up in the news recently. This is one of the danger signs. When banks, rather than paying you interest on deposits, offer to have you pay them for the safety of being on deposit at the bank, it means that they're not making enough money on the loan side of their business, because people are paying their loans off too fast, which means that the safety that you are getting is not something they're paying you for. It's something you have to pay them for.
Right.
And that means that just having money becomes more valuable. And people may say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, this is something that a lot of people mess up. They really don't understand this. When they think of inflation, they think inflation is a really, really horrible thing. It is. Inflation's not good, so don't get me wrong there.
I don't agree with that.
A little inflation is good.
It's a wonderful thing.
A lot of inflation is bad, but they think this is going to hurt your average citizen. And the reality is that it hurts the rich people a lot more than it hurts the poor people. And let me explain this. Let me go to the other direction, because deflation hurts poor people or people that have less money a lot more than it hurts rich people. If you have a long-term mortgage and you can't afford to pay it off quickly because you don't have as much money, which by definition, and we're talking about that group already, the people that are trying to put that money away. If they have a long-term mortgage and the dollars become worth more, that means people's pay starts going down. Well, your mortgage doesn't go down with your pay. That's a very real problem. If you have other debts, the debt payments don't go down. If you took a $40,000 loan and through deflation, its equivalent value is $50,000, that's an invisible interest that's added up. And deflation is a lot harder to stop. So when we're talking about how do we keep out of deflation, what is the Fed doing, and why is it pumping so much money into the economy and people are so worried about that, the reality is that if that money didn't come into the economy, we would have a very bad deflation at this point, because a lot of people stopped paying their loans completely. And when that happens, the banks lose money, which means they loan less money, which means that the money becomes worth more, which means that if you do have a loan, you have more to pay back, even though it says the same number.
One of the another aspect of this, and it's a symptom as much as it is a cause, is when we get a large disparity between the low side of the income scale and the high side. In other words, when we get a concentration, another piece of this is we get a concentration of wealth in a very few people. So that, and this is a situation we find ourselves in the economy today, where people, CEOs and people at the top of the income stream, are making, quite literally in the 20th century, a record difference from those towards the bottom. We're in a position where in the 19th century we saw this, but there were far fewer people at the top doing this. But we paid for it rather severely in the 1930s. When people at the top of the income ladder have a huge disparity, when CEOs are making literally hundreds of times as much money as the average worker in their firm, we run into a problem in the economy. It's not a matter of morality. It's not a matter, is there a free market? I'm not convinced there is, because if you look at the boards of directors who hired the CEOs, they are CEOs of other corporations in many cases. So it's kind of an incestuous little deal where we've all agreed to raise each other's salary, and that's a problem. But the difficulty is when wealthy people by definition are people who have enough money, they really don't have to ever work again, and they have excess money above that. When that kind of person receives an extra $1 million, they do not go into the economy and buy $1 million worth of stuff.
No.
They have a tendency to save it.
Either save it, and sometimes they invest it, but which can be a good thing, but it could be something right. That's a net zero to the economy.
A few people invest it. A relatively small number of people invest, but the vast majority simply say,
I have money.
I like my lifestyle, and I'm going to save it. So for instance,
Ross Perot, great example.
Yeah, Ross Perot.
Billions of dollars just sitting in cash equivalent type positions.
Right, and he put them in short-term municipal bonds. Why? Because he didn't like to pay income taxes. Very rational. And because he needed no excess returns, so he put it in very, very, very short-term positions where he didn't pay taxes on it. And he didn't want any gain on it. Well, let me tell you, when he did that, he did not produce jobs in the economy.
No, zero jobs.
He did not produce an incentive for people to go out and make more money by starting a company to sell something to him.
That's what happens when you have deflation,
right.
Is that people just hold on to the money just to hold on to the money, which creates
right.
less money out there, which creates more deflation.
Nice little cycle, but it's... How to solve it is the problem. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I just heard you talking about the disparity between the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
And how it's growing. And
actually,
I heard on the
right.
news that the superintendent of schools in Fort Worth would retire and in the next 3 years get real close to $1 million.
Well, that may not be accurate.
Benefits, that kind of thing.
Well, and over
that
the next,
may not be accurate.
Over the next 3 years. Well, first, let's establish something clearly at the beginning. We're not talking about people shouldn't get paid what they're worth. That's a misnomer. I don't want to get into class warfare where some people are getting paid. We do believe in a market system. I don't think it's completely efficient, but we believe in that. So let's take the next step.
I want to point something out here. When you read a headline like that, start off by the first thing you have to understand is the reporter doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. I followed through on some of those, and what happens is, let's just say, I don't know how long this guy's been working, but let's just say he has a 403B, which is technically the property of the school system, and he has been working for 35 years, and he has been putting 10-20% of his income into that 403B during that 35-year period. Does that make sense to you? He might have done that?
Yeah, it
okay.
could help. And,
well,
and
what'll happen is...
I'm talking to you about it because you can explain this better than I can.
Yeah, when that 403B, he's been deferring his income all this time and investing it, which is a really good thing. When that 403B rolls out... It may be worth $1 million, or probably considering that he'll have a teacher's retirement sort of thing, it may be worth $300,000-$400,000, which would be very reasonable for a person who's able to invest in a 403B all that time and a retirement plan. Well, that counts as part of his, in the next 3 years, he will receive benefits worth.
Yeah.
And
so, yeah.
that, you know. Come on, guys. He deferred that pay over many, many years. He did what he was supposed to do, and some reporter is trying to make a headline saying that the superintendent makes too much money.
Now, it may be, because we haven't looked at this, it may be that there are a lot of extra benefits that you know, anytime you have a headline that's talking about a specific person's income, I get a little bit leery. I like to look at the bigger picture when it comes to the income disparity, because there is an income disparity. There is a reality to the world right now that rich people are getting richer.
This is just one example, but the local superintendent of schools here makes $10,000 a year more than the governor. The city manager in Killeen, they paid him $750,000 to leave. you know, I'm just seeing a growing number of these kinds of situations where the taxpayer who is making an average of, what, $50,000 a year, whatever it is he's making, is having to pay for all this kind of stuff. And talk about a disparity, and you know, that just disturbed me because it seems to be growing.
Well, you know, the school...
To be electing people that are giving these contracts and things like that to public officials, and I don't understand why a superintendent of schools can be worth more than the governor of the state.
Well, let me just say...
I don't understand that.
First off, Texas intentionally pays the governor less than he's worth. We pay $133,000 to the governor. That's the salary. He gets a house as well. He gets to stay in the house. So let's add to that and say that his benefit for living in a house is added to his pay. It's a very nice house. So that puts him up, say, close to $300,000, because I've seen that house. It's a nice house. As soon as you add in the benefits that the governor gets besides just the pay, that disparity goes away. He's the executive of a large institution, and the Fort Worth School District is a great example. How many employees are there? And I'm not saying this to say that there isn't a disparity. I just want to make sure that we recognize that. But if you have a corporation, any corporation in the world, that has thousands of employees, the vast majority of those employees have four-year degrees. That CEO, if it were a corporation, would be paid in the millions of dollars a year. We put a lot of scrutiny on the school districts and say, you know, the Austin School District, for instance, that's one of the biggest in the country. The superintendent is paid very, very, very much more than the governor of Texas. Is that right? That's really the question that is being asked here. What is the morality of paying someone that much more? Anytime we use a comparison, the legislature of Texas, they get paid a very small amount of money, intentionally. Our Constitution says that our elected representatives should not be dependent on their job as a government official to make their money. They need to be working in the society and making an income.
So what you wind up in Texas, by the way, with...
The difference I see, though, between corporate heads making lots and lots of money is that's private money.
And it's for profit.
In the company,
correct,
et cetera.
Yeah.
And they're paid that based on profits, whatever, but it's private money. Whereas school superintendents, et cetera, it's our money.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
And that's the difference to me.
But let me ask you a question. Would you rather have, let's just say that you have a corporation, you're in Killeen, apparently. So let's just say you have a corporation in Killeen that has the same number of employees as the KISD. There isn't one that big outside of the Army, by the way. But let's say there was. And it had the same level of budget as KISD. And so it's going to have a manager. Somebody is going to be the CEO, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, would you rather have, since we have a free market system in this area, almost completely free market system, and there's a guy who is available who can either run this corporation or run KISD. And KISD has many, many, many more headaches because, among other things, they're elected officials running who is board of directors. So the issue is, if you want a really poor school system, then artificially set the salary of the person who's going to be the CEO, we call it superintendent, but is going to be the CEO, so that the smartest, best people all go into private, and you get the people who can't get a job in the private world. You know that old saying, if you can't do, teach? And unfortunately, that's what we wind up with sometimes.
The difference I see, though, is in the private world, that man has to make more profit for the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
That's his incentive to get more money. He has to be more profitable.
Right.
Whereas a lot of the public officials, they simply spend more money. They're less profitable to the system.
Mm-hmm. And you get to
rewarded for getting more federal grants, more spending more money.
But you
and
get
a bigger budget.
You get to elect the board who sets his salary every time we have elections. So the people are electing they're electing people to send to hire the superintendent and to manage the budget, right?
Yeah, I agree. It's the stupidity of the voting public.
Right.
Is what it is.
In other words, let me step in here. Just
voting public.
Yeah, let me step in here just a second, because there's a red herring here. And just as a side note, red herrings were used in the training of coon dogs. You could take a red herring, a actual red herring, which is a smoked fish. It turns red when you smoke it. And you run it through the woods, and the dog would know to chase that smell. So we have a false trail here. It really isn't about how much we're paying the superintendent. It's about quality control. If we're getting what we pay for, we're happy. So let's set that as the premise here. If we paid the superintendent of Austin or Dallas or any place else, of Fort Worth, something that we considered fair because the quality of education that we were getting to the students was good, that would be the point where we wouldn't care what the dollar number was if we got what we felt was valuable. We don't buy with dollars. We buy with value. And the dollar number changes on that value. Otherwise, when we buy a car, we would expect to pay the same price we did for our first car. If you're buying a Mercedes, you're getting something different than when you buy a Kia. And what that means is that if you're buying a Kia, you know you're buying a Kia. If you're buying a Mercedes, you know you're buying a Mercedes. We need to have some transparency on what we're getting for the money. And right now, that's the real issue. We were just at a conference where Condoleezza Rice was talking. And one of her major issues was making sure, one, that we pay our teachers a competitive wage. Absolutely. But two, not just a competitive wage, but a good wage. But two, we have quality control on which teachers are there, because there are some bad anybody that says there are no bad teachers has not been to any schools. There are bad employees everywhere.
The teaching system, the education system in the United States is a socialist system. But we, the people, ensure with our freedom to vote that it stays a socialist system. And it socialist system doesn't work very well, very frankly. I would love to see the whole thing, and I know this sounds absurd, but I would still love to see the whole thing go private. And
you fact got my
is,
vote.
The fact is, the wealthy people in the United States
already have that.
Do not send their children to public schools. And there's a very good reason they don't send their children to public schools, because the public schools do not adequately prepare them to enter into the workforce in most cases.
If they want their kids to be wealthy too, then they need the education on how to deal with the wealth. They need a higher level of education than what is available in a socialist system.
And to put a little nail in this one, when you talk about superintendents, we have the shortest teaching day of any developed country,
and the shortest teaching year
of any developed country on the earth. And then we wonder, and then we can't fire teachers who are substandard, and we wonder why we're falling behind.
Yeah, it's easy to report on the pay of one person. It's really, really hard to make a statement about teachers, because there are amazing teachers out there, and there's amazingly bad teachers out there. And if you make a statement, it has to be big enough to enclose both of them, and that's hard to fit in a headline. It's hard to fit into a soundbite.
Basically, in my humble opinion, need to overhaul our public education system from the ground up. Right now, it's based on an agrarian concept where the kids have to be let go in the summer to go work on the farm. That has got to be one of the dumbest things as a society we could possibly
do. We spend the first third of the year just refreshing what they forgot over the three-month period that they were gone. That means that we've got two-thirds of the year that we're not moving forward. We're either holding steady or backwards.
Anyway.
Well, but let's back to the comparison with corporate America. Look at the product that we're turning out of our high schools in comparison to what we're paying the superintendent.
It's about equal.
That they produce at high school. You're producing seniors out of the 12th grade that can't do anything except play video games. I'm sure there are some outstanding students, but they don't know how to work. They don't know how to produce.
Right. And do you know that?
Why are we paying so much money to
because
some
we put
teachers that are qualified and some that are that ought to be fired the next day. What are we getting for our money?
Well, what we're getting,
the
issue is we the people put handcuffs on the school system and says don't teach the children.
Yeah, we've got to do some commercials. We could go into the next hour talking about this is good stuff.
There a few years ago I said there are two major institutions in the United States that if we don't fix them we'll wreck the country. One of them is healthcare and the other one is public education. We are addressing the healthcare system. We may not be addressing it perfectly and it certainly has flaws. But we're addressing it, and we're debating on it, and we're changing it as we go. And so there's hope there. Public education system is still off limits. You can't tell people, you know, you got to have 3 months off. You got to have a long Christmas vacation. You got to have a short teaching day. This doesn't make any sense. Anyway, we got to do commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And just like a bad penny, we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Aren't all pennies bad by definition at this point?
I don't think so. And I've never actually passed a bad penny, so I don't know if it actually does come back to you.
What is a bad penny?
Well, I think what it was when a penny was worth a relatively significant amount of money, the equivalent of almost a quarter, I think, today, considering you could buy a bag of bird food for two pennies,
mm-hmm.
then I would suggest that there were probably counterfeit pennies.
Hmm.
Where people had stamped them out of something else.
Or even copper, but yeah.
They, you know, get rid of them and then they would wind up getting them back as change a few minutes later or something. I don't know.
Speaking of reforms, let's get rid of the penny.
That would be a good idea. It'd make a lot of sense.
Ha! Ha ha!
Actually,
oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, it's one of those things, by the way, in case you didn't know, folks. It costs the United States more than a penny to print a penny at this point.
Not anymore.
Really? They got it cheaper again?
They put zinc in it instead of copper.
Well, that's been a long time ago.
No, this was several years ago.
The actual process, I read the other day, the actual process of stamping the thing, bagging it, by the time you get it in somebody's pocket where it's actually being used, it costs them about 1.4 cents or something. Not just the creation of the penny itself, but the process of getting it into somebody's pocket.
It costs 1.83 cents.
Okay, so it's costing us 2 cents to make a penny, and my 2 cents worth is that we should probably get rid of them, but nobody... It's like the school systems. It's like the public school system, which was designed again in the 19th century. The system we have in the public school systems today was designed in the 19th century very carefully to support agricultural communities. And then as we got into the 20th century, there was some reform in the 1920s, and it focused quite hard on training children from agricultural families to enter the industrial society. And we kind of got stuck there, and they would send them home in the summer to help on the farm. And we had really, really long Christmas vacations, and the idea of the 9-month school year total somehow became etched in our minds as being mandatory. And any attempt anybody has made so far to change that produces an uproar from the parents who want to take vacations and so on sometime during the 3-month period. And they want the other thing is, if you think about it, the school systems that we have today were set up in the model of the husband working and the wife at home. So you let the kids out at 3:30.
Right.
They come home, mama's home to greet them, but in fact, today we have the average couple both working, which means the kids get let out about an hour and a half before mama or daddy can pick them up.
Right.
That's absurd.
We've got no time left this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting. You can give us ideas for next week's program. You can reach us locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach that voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. Or you can go to our webpage, tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got podcasts. We've got ugly pictures to look at, and some good ones for the people that work at the office. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.